We've seen it reach a new all-time low, surpassing October's all-time low. And what we've really seen in the last few months really is sort of a reflection of what's been happening in the economy.
Hello and welcome to Planet Money. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. It's Tuesday, December 30th at 4 p.m. That was Lynn Franco you just heard talking. She's the director of the Conference Board Consumer Research. And she was talking about this month's consumer confidence number and how it's at an all-time low, which is especially troubling because it had increased slightly in November, so people might have thought that things were getting better.
And Alex, I got to say, this is one of those phrases you hear all the time. Consumer confidence rose or consumer confidence shrank. I feel like this is Planet Money's, this is what we got to do, right? We have to explain what that means.
Take it away, sir.
All right, because I was confused about it a while ago, and I decided to find out. And what I learned is this. There's this, it's not a government organization. It's the conference board in Michigan. And every month they call about 5,000 people and they basically say, how do you think the economy's doing? Do you think it's going to be doing better or worse in 6 months? And they take all that data and they come up with a number that shows are people more optimistic or less optimistic. I also learned that there's a lot of people who think this is a ridiculous number. It means nothing. It's not like unemployment or GDP where there's an actual real world equivalent. It's just the views of some people and it doesn't really mean anything. Other people say, no, it means a lot. I say we sit out whether it means a lot or means a little. But just when you hear consumer confidence, think survey of people asking them, how's the economy doing and how's it going to be doing in the next few months?
And that is not the only gloomy news. The S&P Case-Shiller House Price Index, which tracks home values in 20-year cities, says that home values fell at the fastest pace on record this month. They're off an average of 18% from a year earlier and off 23% from the peak in 2006.
So basically, if you bought a house for $400,000 2 years ago, it's now worth $300,000
on average,
something like,
yes,
on average.
Some
right.
places worse, some places better. Yeah,
right. Like if you were in Dallas, which had the smallest decline, it's only down a tiny bit. But if you were in Phoenix or Las Vegas or San Francisco, then it's down even more than $100,000.
Right, and that was one of those little notes that was in this report that I was actually a little surprised by. They had the worst cities basically for house price declines, and it was Phoenix and Las Vegas, which I feel like I was a little familiar with. But then San Francisco was in there also, which I was a little surprised by.
Yeah, that is surprising.
Yeah, their home values are off over 30%.
I mean, it's upsetting, but I feel like every week we're like reporting, okay, worst house prices decline ever, worst consumer confidence ever. Anyway.
So. Right. Maybe it helps to know that the misery is spread out around the globe.
You're talking about our Planet Money indicator, 8.1.
Yes. 8.1.
That is the percentage by which Japanese industrial output fell during the month of November, 8.1%. So if you think of all the factories in Japan, how much stuff they made, in November they made almost 10% less stuff than they did in October, which is the biggest fall off. That's just a huge fall off, the biggest ever since Japan started recording how its factories do. Just a shocking drop off for Japan.
Right. And they started recording this stuff in the 1950s. And we get this information from this research note from Danske Bank, which is a Danish bank. And this research note is sort of unusual, I think, Adam. You get a lot of these things, right? These research notes?
Yeah, every day I get hundreds of emails from banks and researchers, research companies and others just saying we're analyzing this part of the economy or that part of the economy. And they send them out to investors and to the media and to other people.
And I'm betting that I'm not going out on a limb here when I say that they're not the most the language is pretty dry, sort of like investment decreased over Q4 by this amount, et cetera, that sort
Yeah,
of thing,
I mean,
right?
Some are literally just numbers. Others are like the tersest, most dry sentences you've ever seen. But not this one, not today's
right.
report on Japanese industrial output. As our friend and colleague David Kestenbaum pointed out, he pointed out that this report has the most exclamation points he's ever seen in a financial research report,
which might be a new, Planet Money indicator that we can start the exclamation point index. But there are not one but two exclamation points in this report, which is only 2 pages long, by the way. So, and I'm just going to read
one per page.
One per page. So this is an exclamation per page rate of one. And I'm just going to read one here. It says, industrial production will have contracted close to 20% during Q4 08. How does that sound?
That sounds good. Yeah, I was always taught to write it so you don't need the exclamation point.
Right.
Actually use words that convey a sense of drama, but rather than just a punctuation that conveys a sense of drama.
But what are they saying? They're just basically saying that
they're saying this is nuts, that you never, ever, ever in any modern economy see, you know, all modern economies, there's bubbles and bobbles, and, you know, sometimes factories make more stuff, sometimes they make less stuff. But for them to make 80% as much stuff in a short period of time, that is, it just never happens. It's just crazy. I mean, that means if you went to every factory in Japan, on average, like one machine out of five isn't working, or one guy out of five isn't working. And it shows that basically what we already know, but it's just yet another dramatic example that the global consumer is not buying stuff, factories are not making stuff. It's shocking.
Right. Which brings us to the next segment of our report, which is Barack Obama, basically. I think nobody's more aware of the gloomy economic news than him. He's been assembling a pretty impressive team of economic advisors to help him figure out what to do. There's Paul Volcker, the legendary former chairman of the Fed, who's credited by many with getting us out of the last big economic crisis we had in the 70s. Larry Summers, who's the former president of Harvard University. Pretty much everybody on his team. You know, you look at all the resumes and you're constantly bumping into Ivy League educations and sort of dramatic overachievement at every turn.
Yeah, I was just talking to a very right-wing conservative economist who doesn't like anything about Obama's plan, but did at least say this is an unbelievably impressive group of economists. This is the best and the brightest. And that is one of the reasons people are comparing this to Kennedy. I mean, you're hearing this phrase, the new Camelot. I mean, you have this young, charismatic president. You have this fanatical support for him, this mandate to change things fundamentally. You have this belief that he's not just going to be a politician. He's going to just get the smartest people in the world into his administration, and they're going to come up with the solutions to the problems, the right solutions. So I decided to talk about this with Robert Samuelson, the columnist for Newsweek and The Washington Post, because he has this book out right now called The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence, which might not sound like it, but it's a book that deals a lot with Kennedy's administration and what happens when you get the smartest economists in the world to meet together at the White House and decide to fix the economy.
And you called him up basically to find out how it worked out for Kennedy. Did the team he assembled actually, were they brilliant enough to actually fix the economy?
I would say they were brilliant, but they did not fix the economy, and everything that they planned turned out not to work. They expected to create an economic policy in which there was faster growth, fewer recessions, and less unemployment. What in fact happened was that, and there was very little inflation. They expected a little bit more inflation, but not much more. What happened was there was a lot more inflation. Inflation went from about 1% at the beginning of the 60s to about 6% at the end of the 60s. And with ups and downs, it got to double-digit levels by the mid-70s and double-digit levels at the end of the 70s and early 80s. There were more recessions as the Federal Reserve strove to rein in this inflation, so that you had recessions in 1969, 70, 1973, 75, 1980, and then 1981, 82. On average, unemployment was higher and not lower. So the policies worked out exactly the opposite of what they were intended to work out to happen.
Do we know why?
Yes, we know why. The ideas on which they were based were unrealistic. And even if they had been realistic, the government could not respond as quickly as the economists wanted the response, and there was an inflationary bias in the policies.
So let's stop right there, Adam. Like inflation, he just said a word, inflationary bias. What does that mean?
He just means the government was spending a lot of money it didn't have, and when a government spends a lot of money it doesn't have, when it borrows money and it goes into a deficit, it usually causes inflation.
But it might not cause it right away, right?
Right. That's kind of the one of the most powerful things that Samuelson taught me, is that the policy, there might be a problem in a policy, but it might not appear for years, maybe even decades.
I think you have, as difficult as it is to contemplate and predict the consequences of policies that we undertake today, you have to try at least to think ahead 10 or 15 years, because the initial effects of these policies was to create a boom. It was ultimately an inflationary boom, but it was very pleasurable. In the 1960s, the country went through an economic boom that was really unrivaled until we had a similar boom in the 1990s. And for 4 or 5 years, it looked like these policies were succeeding admirably and doing just what the economists thought they would do. But in the end, it turned out that the long-term unintended consequences of these policies were much worse and had much graver effects than almost anyone anticipated in the 1960s.
Okay, so I mean, what does this mean for Obama's team? I mean, is the same thing going to happen to him that happened to Kennedy?
Yeah, that's exactly what I wanted to know. I asked Samuelson about that.
Well, I do and I don't. I think that, first place, I think that we should have a stimulus. The collapse in demand here has been pervasive and profound, and in a very crude way, when private demand collapses, not just in the United States but around the world, you ought to be a little bit worried that it's not going to bounce back of its own accord, and you need some offsetting force here, and the only offsetting force here is to have public demand go up. Where I am a little bit skeptical or worried, this is only at best a temporary solution, and you need to have private demand regenerate itself, and we're not seeing much talk about the policies that are needed to do this, which are difficult policies. The first, you need to find something in the United States to offset the collapse in consumer spending, or at least the decline in consumer spending. But part of the problem here is international. It is that the Asian countries, particularly China, consumers there save too much and spend too little. And in the United States, we spend too much and save too little. Now, if we can reverse those patterns, we will have a sustainable economic recovery at some point. But if we can't reverse those two patterns, if the Asians continue to save too much and spend too little, and the Americans then reverse their current, or at least their recent past behavior of spending too much and saving too little, and they begin to save more and spend less, then we have the ingredients of a prolonged global economic slump. And how to reverse this international imbalance is really the core of our current problem. And there's not very much talk about how to do this.
Thank you to Robert Samuelson, author of The Great Inflation and Its Aftermath, The Past and Future of American Affluence.
And be sure to check out our year-end slideshow on the on our blog, npr.org/money. It's this really great sort of the year end in pictures that you, our listeners, have sent in to us.
Pretty awesome.
Great.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
Yeah.
We won't be podcasting tomorrow or Thursday, but we'll be back on Friday and then pretty much back to normal next week. I'm Adam Davidson.
And I'm Alex Bloomberg. Thanks for listening. Come look in my shoes and see the way I'm living if you really want to. Got my mind on my money and I'm not going away. So keep on getting your paper.